science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
All right, science in studio with me, Alan Blackman. How are you, Alan?
I'm very well, Lisa. All good.
All right, that's a short and brief introduction. That's all good.
Well, what else is to say, really? I mean, it's week three of semester. And, yeah. You know,
that's well, is it still fresh and new and there's not much to say about it?
No, I'm getting into the laboratory. That's fun, actually.
Yes. Oh, cool.
I've got a couple of grad students, so, you know. Yeah.
Oh, getting that's
up there,
fun.
Helping them, so that's all good. Getting your hands
is it better than first year students? Yeah, I don't want to say it.
No.
That's all right.
First year's a performance. That's, you know, you stand in front and give a performance. So, yeah. They're all good in their own way. There we go.
All How's right. That? That's a very diplomatic response.
Yes.
Okay, so first topic of the day. It's pretty exciting. Apparently, scientists have found an underground lake on Mars.
Yeah. This is a big deal. Obviously, a very big deal. And we talked, a month or two ago about finding organic molecules on Mars. And they are one thing that you're going to need for life. Another thing that you're going to need for life, obviously, is water.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes way back to 1877. And there was an Italian astronomer by the name of Giovanni Schiaparelli. And he reckoned he saw canals on Mars.
Okay.
And you guys, no.
Okay.
So that was the big thing on Mars. Everyone thought that there were canals on Mars after he came along. He'd looked at it through his telescope. And,
yeah.
And so they're obviously canals. So obviously there were little green men on Mars and women probably, who'd made these canals. And so this is a big thing. And I think I may be wrong, but that might have been the inspiration for War of the Worlds, H.G. Wells's story about about Martians coming, and you know, sort of based on the fact that these canals couldn't be anything else other than made by an intelligent civilization. Unfortunately, they were an optical illusion, basically.
So.
But that got people thinking about obviously water on Mars and everything, and with the advent of space probes that went to look at Mars and everything, we now know that there's solid ice on the South Pole and the North Pole on Mars, which means obviously there's water on Mars. But now the interesting thing here is there's liquid water on Mars. And that's important for life, obviously. Now, the interesting thing that this is liquid water at a temperature, what they estimate, roughly about minus 68 degrees Celsius.
So is that solid form?
Well, no, it's not. It's liquid. There's the interesting thing.
Hmm. How does that happen?
Wow. So I was hoping you'd ask that. I really was. Because this is
doesn't Mars get even, like, much... Doesn't Mars get a lot colder than that at night?
Yes, this is sort of thought to be the subterranean temperature.
Oh, right.
So they've found this water at a depth of about 1.5 kilometers. So they're using radar imaging and everything. And what we have on Earth, we have sort of similar things. We have what are called subglacial lakes, and they've got a temperature about minus 60 degrees, and they are still water. So it may surprise you that the 16th largest lake in the world is in Antarctica. Mars isn't in the world, Darish Fred.
Well, it's in the global world. It's not our one.
So the 16th largest liquid water lake is in Antarctica.
Okay.
It's just buried 4 kilometres under the ice shelf. Okay.
Yeah.
And water's got this really weird property that if you pressurise it, its melting point lowers.
Mm.
So these subglacial lakes have got tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of ice pressing down on them. And so they keep liquid via that mechanism, via this intense pressure. Now, on Mars, it's obviously not the same because these aren't subglacial lakes. This is just a lake that's under, you know, the Martian surface, which isn't a glacier. So how does this stay liquid at a temperature of minus 68?
Yes.
And the trick here is that it must be full of salts.
Okay. Mm.
Okay, so if you take, for example, sodium chloride and mix it up with water and you try and freeze it, it freezes at a lot lower temperature than zero, okay? And so this is their idea that it's very, very rich in salt, and so that keeps it liquid even
so
at a very, very low temperature.
How are they sure that it's liquid water?
It's from the radar signature.
Okay.
So they can distinguish liquid water from ice. So don't ask me how. But
and also, I mean, sorry, I'm cutting you, but it's interesting because we think that because we've got water, we've got an environment for life,
mm-hmm. Yep.
Which is the next thing that they're going to be looking into, I assume?
Yeah, I would imagine so. So,
and so what kind of life are we talking about?
Well, microbial life,
okay.
And to start off with anyway. And what they say is that with these subglacial lakes, they've been isolated from the rest of the world for like millions of years, especially this one in Antarctica. And supposedly there is evidence of life in those. Even after they've been isolated for that long, at those extreme pressures and those very, very cold temperatures, there's still life down there, supposedly. It's not absolutely been proven. And so they're sort of surmising that the same thing could happen on Mars, that this big underground lake could hold life. They don't know that. The other thing they don't know is the depth of the lake. So, again, radar can only tell you so much. So it could be sort of tens of centimetres deep. At a minimum to a maximum of goodness knows what, but
okay.
And they also don't know whether it's just an isolated lake and that's the only one there is, or whether it's part of a system of underground lakes, etc., etc. So obviously more research is needed, which is always, you know, that's that famous scientific line. And the spacecraft that's doing this, the thing called Mars Express, and it is sort of nearing the end of its useful life, so if they want to find out stuff, they've got to hurry up.
Don't they have a second one coming?
Chances are they probably will, I think.
Okay.
But yeah, but it's a matter of whether it's got this equipment on it or not.
Yep.
You know, it's very, very specialised equipment. And the data that they used for this was collected between apparently 2012 and 2015. So it's only just been published. So there's a significant sort of time lag between actually picking up the data and then analysing the data and then publishing the data. So, but, you know, very, very exciting.
Yeah.
And it's been surmised that some of the outer planets as well, and some of the moons, in fact, of Saturn have got sort of large underground lakes and everything. So, you know, water may be more abundant in the universe, in the solar system than we knew before.
Yeah, maybe there's lots of little green men and women all around. That's exciting. I know.
Indeed.
I know that it's not true.
We'll see.
All right, moving on to the next topic, which you yourself labelled as, and I quote you, astonishing and just mind-blowing. So go on, blow our minds.
Well, this is, and quite frightening, really, if we're going to be brutally honest. Okay. So Siberia is pretty much covered in permafrost, basically. So a very, very cold part of the world.
Can you just quickly explain to our listeners what permafrost is?
Absolutely.
And so, remind myself.
So permafrost is when the ground doesn't thaw out during the year. Okay. So, and Siberia is a good place for that because it's, you know, pretty damn cold in the winter. And so when it does thaw out, when the ground thaws out in Siberia, it's about sort of 80 centimetres or so maximum,
mm-hmm.
okay? And then below that, it's just solid ice forever and ever, amen.
Okay.
And they estimate that only, in the last 100,000 years, the permafrost has never melted below a depth of 1.5 metres. That's the absolute extreme.
Last how many years?
Over the last 100,000.
Okay.
So what they've done, they've taken these cores from the permafrost and they're analysing them and they found these nematodes in them, these little worms, okay? And these little worms can be sort of 0.1 of a millimetre to about 2.5 millimetres long or whatever.
So they're really tiny.
Yeah, so these tiny little things. And these guys, so the bore that they got them out of, they radiocarbon dated to ages, or in two bores in fact, ages of 30,000 years and 42,000 years, okay?
Yeah.
And they found these worms, they warmed them up to 20 degrees, gave them some agar and stuff to eat, and some E. coli, and they started living. They moved around and started feeding, and they had been frozen, estimated for 42,000 years. And
that's insane.
Yeah.
Mind-blowing?
Yes. It is, I'll give you that.
It's like in Stranger Things, and that thing comes out, and then they feed it.
Okay.
No, that's a lie.
Nobody watches it.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about.
I think we've got the generation gap thing going here. never heard of it.
That's all right.
But
I'm thinking like the piece of amber from Jurassic Park, extracting the DNA.
There you go. That's more your time.
Oh,
It's not that old at all.
Oh, I thought you were sort of right. talking, you know, the eyes from the Jurassic.
No, of course not. Dinosaur time. What about when Jurassic Park was released? No, like in the 90s or something. Come on.
Yes, no, no.
None taken. Anyway, so, those frightening worms that can live.
Okay, so they do something special. And so the trouble with being frozen, and Harry was talking about Walt Disney being frozen before, yeah. which may or may not be an urban myth, we don't know. The trouble with that is that water in your cells, so when water freezes, it expands. And mm-hmm. again, that's a weird thing about water. You pressurize it and the freezing point lowers, and when it freezes, it expands. Two things that sort of normal liquids don't do.
Yeah.
So if it expands, all of your cells in your body which contain water, they rupture when the water freezes. And that's why probably Walt Disney won't be able to be brought back to life if he is indeed frozen, because all of the cells and the vital organs and everything will have ruptured. But these nematodes can apparently expel the liquid, that water, from their cells when they feel the temperature getting down to around about zero, whatever, which is utterly bloody astonishing. Yeah. I don't know how the hell that works, but, you know, absolutely incredible. And prior to this, they had done studies on these nematode worms, and they'd found that they could wake them up after they'd been frozen for 39 years.
Okay, so they just go...
So, you know, shit, 42,000 years, you know, if you can do it for 39, you can do it for 42,000.
They did go into this, like, maybe, like, a little bit hopeful, thinking maybe this will happen.
Well,
we might as well give it a go. Yeah. We got them, so...
This is utterly, utterly astonishing.
So why do you think it's frightening?
Well,
because it's just worms, like, obviously not, I don't know.
Yeah, but
ethically speaking, it's nothing. It's
still 42,000 year old organism.
Yeah, but it's, I don't know.
What might it do to the, you know, if it gets out, you know, all this stuff? Who knows? But I just, is quite,
it freaks you
quite
out.
Quite incredible. Yeah, no, it does. It absolutely freaks me out. I prefer to work with inanimate objects in the chemistry lab, not these things that, you know, can grow and breathe.
Are you going to have nightmares of them tonight?
Probably. Little worms.
Tiny little worms
going in your
coming.
Brain or whatever. Yeah.
Just don't go to Siberia. You'll be fine.
Ancient diseases.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I suppose that's one interesting point that can be made.
Yes. Yeah.
That could lead to some pretty devastating things. If we wake up from the dead, well, not really dead, I suppose, the organisms that carry pretty bad stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's all the elements of a bad science fiction story, isn't it?
Yeah, true.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe someone should look into that. All right, final topic, because I think we've got about 2 minutes
left.
Oh,
jeez.
I know.
Only ever had 2 minutes for the last one. Yeah.
All right, okay, I'll give you like maybe 3 or something. So you're trying to make statistics appealing to...
Yes. Yes.
The rest of us.
Who would have thought you could do that?
I know. And so you're mixing statistics with the Beatles.
Yes.
And you, come on, fascinate me with your statistics.
Not my statistics, but some guy from Harvard and some guy from Dalhousie University, which is in Canada. And they were Beatles fans, and they realised that some of the authorship of the Beatles songs was sort of up in the air. So we've got, you know, the word of Paul McCartney and John Lennon as to who wrote what. And most of the songs, as I understand anyway, was sort of primarily written by one, and then the other one would come in and add a verse or a chorus or something like that, and blah, blah, blah. And so there was around about 70 songs written by those two between 1962 and 1966, which whose authorship is undoubted, so we know that. However, there's one song, which is on Rubber Soul, which is called In My Life, and John Lennon swore that he wrote it when he was still alive, and Paul McCartney said, oh, no, he came up with the lyrics and I came up with the music. And so these guys decided to see that if through analysis of all of the songs that they know were written by one or other of them, whether they could figure out the probability that In My Life was written by either McCartney or Lennon. And so long story short, this analysis involved things like sort of chord progressions, the frequency of notes. They cut the whole song into these sort of 4-note bits and saw whether the melody goes up, down, or stays the same.
Mm.
And then they applied this thing called Bayesian statistics, which I have no bloody idea what it is, but I often see it. No, not a clue. I don't know any stats anyway. But they sort of swear that. So the long and the short of it is that the chances that In My Life was written by Paul McCartney is 0.018. Okay, which
makes it... That's funny, because McCartney claims that it was...
Yeah, So, yes. But it was a wee while ago, I guess. So, you know, who remembers what they were doing? You know, if you can remember the 60s, you weren't there or something.
Do you think he would know whether he wrote that or not? I don't know. I find that a bit hard to believe.
You do, but they're both sort of claiming it. But then on the other hand, there's a song called The Word, which is an even better song than Rubber Soul, in my opinion, which Lennon reckoned he wrote, but now they reckon through this analysis, it's almost certainly McCartney's song.
Oh, okay. Okay, I do think that maybe the analysis is wrong? Or?
Well, this is statistics. So, as the great Ernest Rutherford once said, if your experiment relies on statistics, then you need a better experiment.
Ouch. So, yeah. Okay. All right. Sorry, all the statisticians out there. That was a bit...
Well, that's what he said. Hey, yeah. You know, who's going to argue with, you know, with Ernest Rutherford?
Sheesh.
All right. So you're saying that it's...
100.
100.
Yes. Ooh. Oh. Apple Run Anata's on the 50. Come on.
My bad. Anyway, you're saying that it's an interesting analysis that still shouldn't fully be trusted.
Well, it's keeping some statisticians in business anyway, and probably bringing statistics to the limelight, I would imagine, which is not necessarily a bad thing. No. So, very interesting. Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, that was Dear Science for today. You can find that on the Bcast section. Again, listen to all our podcasts. They're really cool. And we will see you next week.
Surely will. See ya.
Yeah. See ya.
Bye.
That was Dear Science.